New Thinking Aloud is presented by the California Institute for Human Science, Mind, Body, Spirit University, a leader in fully accredited in-person and online U.S. college degree programs in the topics we cover here. Visit their website at cihs.edu.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlov.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlov. Today I'm going to have an open-ended conversation with Jack Kornfield, who is an American writer and teacher in the Vipassana movement in American Theravada Buddhism. He trained as a Buddhist monk in Thailand, Burma, and India, first as a student of the Thai forest master Ajahn Chah and Mahasi Sayadaw of Burma. He has taught meditation, mindfulness worldwide since 1974, and he is the author of many books, including The Wise Heart, After Ecstasy, The Laundry, The Art of Forgiveness, A Path with Heart, No Time Like the Present, Bringing Home the Dharma, A Lamp in the Darkness, and The Path of Insight Meditation. I first interviewed Jack nearly 40 years ago at the very beginning of my television career. We had just started what is became the Thinking Aloud channel, but at that time it was so new, we called it The Mind's Eye, 1986. And I'm going to link to that video for those of you who are able to capture the link on your computers so you can see what Jack and I both looked and sounded like almost 40 years ago. Jack lives in California, and now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Jack. It is a pleasure, and I have to say a blessing, to be with you again after 38 years since our previous interview.
My pleasure, too. And yes, a wee bit of time has passed, and here we still are. It's great.
I think so as well. It's really a joy to know that you've been out there teaching the Buddha Dharma and meditation practice all these years. I know I watched our earlier interview earlier today just to help prepare, and I could see that 38 years ago, I was a different person. It almost felt like somebody else doing the interview, somebody who was a little more impatient. Of course, back then, we had a 30-minute time limit, actually 27-minute time limit, and I was trying so hard to cram as much as possible into the limited time that we have. I think over the decades, I've relaxed a lot more, and I wonder how you feel about any new insights or ways of being for yourself over the intervening decades.
Well, it's first just great to take a pause. You know, when I think of you watching that show, which I didn't go back and look at, I probably should have. You know, there are many things we should do, and many we don't, even though we should. When I think back over these last decades, there are a lot of things that are both surprising and evolutionary, and I'll speak of them in ways that I think might be interesting or helpful to people who listen. One of the surprising elements is how widespread mindfulness and its ancillary practices of love and kindness and compassion have become. When I was a kid, you look at the National Geographic magazine, they would talk about yogis or yoga in India, and you'd see these half-naked guys in a loincloth doing strange postures, and it seemed otherworldly, like a very, very different part of the world and culture. And now there's a yoga studio, a Starbucks, and a mindfulness class is on, you know, every corner. So something remarkable has happened. And yoga, of course, preceded the mindfulness movement, but it opened the doorway for people to understand that there's another way to inhabit our body and our mind. Another thing that's really been a part of that evolution is that there's been such great science. There's 8,000 or 10,000 research projects and papers on the benefits of training the mind and the heart in mindfulness and loving kindness and compassion. So it's been incorporated in schools and businesses and in athletics. George Mumford, the great, you know, mindfulness coach of the Chicago Bulls and the LA Lakers, and all of these things, all of this was a surprise. My friends and dear beloved colleagues like Sharon Salzberg and Joseph Goldstein, we came back from Asia, from India and Thailand, and people asked us, what did you learn? And we talked to our friends. We had no idea. So there's this kind of joy in watching mindfulness-based stress reduction, Jon Kabat-Zinn, things all over. But there's a deeper current, and that is that we live in a culture that in many ways could be defined by the absence of the sacred. In modern culture, we're so busy with consuming and work and news and all of these things and getting and moving that we've forgotten how to stop, how to listen, how to see, as the poets say, when the eyes and the heart are open, the leaves on the trees become like pages in the holy books. We've lost in many ways the sense of mystery and the deep connections that used to be part of both the villages, but also the villages and the environment, the snakes and the badgers and the, you know, creatures of the forest were all part of an ecosystem. And now you can feel this great longing in the culture to return, partly out of pain, which is one of the great human teachers. It seems like we need it sometimes. Climate change and the loss of species, we wake up and say, we have to do something. We've missed, we haven't paid attention. We've gone the wrong road. And so part of what's happened is surprising. And part of it is the revolutionary return to the possibility of human beings living in a society based on love and connection, connection to the self and connection to others. So that's one thing. And it's kind of extraordinary to see, because none of us did it. If people would come to the centers that I've started, the Spirit Rock Center, Insight Meditation Society, with other friends, say, wow, that looks like a lot of work. It was work, but mostly it happened by itself because it was time and the culture was ready. And there was this very deep longing to have spiritual practices that weren't about belief, whatever religious or belief system, but they're an invitation to live in a different way, connected with our own heart and our connection with others. Zen master Dogen said to become awakened is to become intimate. Intimate with the breath and one's own mysterious body. Intimate with all of the field of life, because that's all I could describe it, an energetic field of life that we're a part of. And of course, all the forms in it. So that's a beginning of an answer to what you put out. I've also changed the way I teach, and that's a whole other talk about. But
well, let's go into that a little bit. I know the world has changed, of course, since we spoke, but I imagine that teaching mindfulness for so many decades can't but help deepen the work that you do.
Yes. Well, mindfulness, just to make it clear, it can be a practice where we train ourselves to be present because our attention tends to be scattered and lost in the past and lost in the future. And mindfulness is an invitation, as Ram put it, to be here now, to live in the reality of the present, to see the eyes of the person across from you, to feel the mystery of your own breath, to taste and savor the food, or to feel the immense suffering, the ocean of tears of humanity, and the unbearable beauty of the world together. Mindfulness is, in that sense, a kind of opening of heart-mind. And it's also a shift of identity from this separate self, where we feel ourselves separate in the U.S., you know, cowboy history reinvents it, to experience, even just now as we talk, that this is a field of consciousness, that the flapping of my tongue and lips and the vibration of the air to the speaker and the little electrons that flow through our devices and the radio waves and all the things that make this possible, and the little drum in your ear that's beating and giving you rhythms that you make this mystery of language come into images. Nobody understands this. Honestly, I can say pink elephant and you see it. How can that be? Because it's consciousness speaking to itself. So mindfulness brings us into the present, and then what's the line from Mary Oliver where she says, I was a bride married to amazement. So it opens us to a kind of mystery way beyond that sense of our separate self. Because we're not this kind of skin encapsulated being. That's just a vehicle. You know, we have parking spots. I'm happy to be in a desk with a parking spot for this physical body. But who I am in Africa, said Archbishop Tutu, when someone asked, you are, at least in South Africa, he said, we always answer in the plural. That's because if you say, how are you? If I'm fine, but my grandmother is sick, I would say, we are not so well. The answer is always that we are part of something much larger. And part of what mindfulness does, it brings us here and it opens the eyes and the heart. I was invited to teach at the first White House Buddhist Leadership Gathering, which was under Barack Obama. 120 wonderful leaders from around the country, many of them from the immigrant temples and communities of the Cambodian or Tibetan or Sri Lankan or Japanese and so forth, and many also from the Western convert community, Spirit Rock or San Francisco Zen Center or whatever. And everybody talked about what they were doing. Most had beautiful bodhisattva projects, bodhisattva, the being that serves the world from the great heart of love. Soup kitchens, helping refugees, all these great things. And I was about the last speaker, kind of summarizing what happened. And I reflected and said, you know, there are many beautiful teachings that we've inherited from our ancestors about wise society. Plato talked about the elements of a wise society, and Confucius and the Chinese sages did, and the Iroquois nation. It's part of all these cultures. And the Buddhist tradition speaks about why society where people treat each other with respect, everyone, where the weak and vulnerable, the children, the women, and so forth, are cared for, protected, where the environment is included in the care and respect, these kind of elements, where there's honesty and integrity is valued. I said, so I can recite these from so many places. What our Buddhist tradition has to offer is the practices that allow us to learn and deepen and embody these so that they're not just a philosophical ideal. But how do you practice compassion when you've been wronged? How do you practice forgiveness when you're at the hands of others? Not you who I'm talking about, but me. But you know it's all of us. How do you practice loving kindness in a world where there's hatred? And how do you practice it in a way that you can carry a heart that's both steady and strong to stand up for what's right, and at the same time, joyful and peaceful? And this is the awakened heart that's possible for you as a human being. And the gift of these teachings is, here's how you do it. Here's a practice of forgiveness. And when I was first taught forgiveness, the teacher who told me how to do an inner visualization and recitation, and he said, at the beginning, it may be painful, it may be hard, it may not even feel right. You don't want to paper it over. You don't want to pretend to forgive. Maybe you just have to grieve or suffer or feel your rage. But in time, here's the practice. And he said, give it a try. I said, well, how much is a try? And he said, how about twice a day for the next 6 months? 10 minutes. And I thought, wait. 6 months, twice a day. He wants me to do it 300 times. And I thought, this is actually how we change. It's one of the ways we change, is by having an invitation of a practice to be present, and then you do it. I did it for 10 minutes, and I feel, I'm never going to forgive that person. And I just hold that with compassion. And 3 weeks later, I'd still feel that, but not as much. I go, you know, they did what they did because of their suffering. And it's actually not so personal. It's not about me. Maybe it's about their suffering or the world around them. And to have practices, very simple but powerful ones, the mind and heart can be opened and trained. And it's a beautiful thing. Now, in my years of teaching, the emphasis has also changed. I spent the first years after being in a really strict monastic training and doing 18 hours a day of silent meditation or living in an ascetic forest monastery with one meal a day for a long time through the cold season and the hot season and, you know, very intense sitting up all night, kind of teach a more warrior-like way in the West. Sit through everything, don't move, be mindful if you feel like you're swept away by sadness or fear or anger, just name it, bow to it, and sit there and say anger, fear, and become that mindful witness of it all. But I learned that people judge themselves in this culture a great deal, and it really tears at the heart. So many people come in, and the suffering we carry because of the harsh critic. I mean, no one would put you on the bench in a civilized country as a judge. You'd have to go, you know, work for Idi Amin in the worst period of his reign, say, yeah, that's the kind of judge I want. So what does it mean to open your heart and be present with love to this mysterious and difficult and fabulous human life. We were sitting with the Dalai Lama in this famous conversation a couple of decades or more ago and asked him about self-hatred. And he kind of startled and looked back and went back and forth with his translator. What is this self-hatred? There's not a word for it in Tibet. And finally it got explained to him. And he looked up and he said, but this is a mistake. And then he asked how many of these, 30 of us who were teachers in the room with him had experienced it. And almost every hand went up. He said, tell me. Explain, we live in a culture where we've internalized the judgment of how we should look and how we should feel and how we appear and what success looks like. And so in a way that at times can be denigrating, even punishing. And then you think of a child doing that to themselves, because almost that's what it almost feels like. And so what we learned very quickly is that mindfulness misunderstood could be used as a kind of assessment. Oh, there's the anger and there's the fear and there's the self-judgment and so forth, as if you were trying to turn it into a new grim duty. I go to the gym and work out and I have a trainer and I'm on a diet and now I'm going to practice mindfulness and make it better, which is full of judgment. And so instead it became more and more for all of us, the practice of mindful, loving awareness. And that's Ram Dass's beautiful language of putting these things together, that to actually be present is an act of love for one another, for a child, an elder, a garden, a country, an ocean, a species. To be present is an act of love. And that's what the world invites you and me and us to embody, to remember, to be. So now I've been reflecting for quite a while, Jeffrey. What do you think?
Oh, there's so much in what you said, and naturally I have many, many thoughts. I remember from our conversation 38 years ago, we just at the end touched briefly on the field which has been my professional interest all these years of psychic functioning and parapsychology. And you mentioned in passing that there are Buddhist teachings for developing psychic abilities. We didn't linger on that topic. But subsequently, it's dawned on me that one of the ways we block our own psychic abilities is we don't want to let the pain of the world in. So we numb ourselves. And I've always thought that the best way to open up to a wider, higher awareness or even remote viewing, other forms of psychic intelligence, is to be more compassionate, to let the pain of the world in. Otherwise, we have this suit of armor around ourselves, and it's something I struggle with still. I often say to myself that my goal is to love everyone and everything all the time, but it's just a goal. I'm not there yet. And what I hear from you is there's a way to get there.
Yeah, thank you, Jeffrey. So we tend to think of spiritual practice as a grim duty, as I said, but it's actually an invitation to joy. It's an invitation to the laughter of the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Tutu teasing each other. And in spite of all the suffering of the world that they've lived through, that there's something magnificent about being alive and its beauty. And then what you point to, which is so important for us, is to not turn our gaze from the suffering. James Baldwin put it this way. He said, one of the reasons that people cling to their hate and prejudice so stubbornly is that they sense that if hate were gone, they would be forced to deal with their own pain. And so when we can't acknowledge the grief we carry about the climate or about what happened to our ancestors or about the children of Sudan right now in the millions who are hungry or starving, when we can't acknowledge the grief in our family or our country, we project it and somebody else carries it. It's the immigrants, the Mexicans. When I grew up, it was the communists. They're sort of coming back around as a fashionable enemy du jour. It's the black people, the red people, the yellow people, somebody else people. It's the gays or whatever. Because we can't bear the uncertainty of life. Life is gloriously uncertain. It's what makes it interesting. You know, when you do a theater production, and there's the most famous actor in the world, Sir John Gielgud, and there's also, in one of the scenes, a child, a little child, or a dog. Everybody watches the dog or the child, because John Gielgud is already programmed. You kind of know where it's going to go. The dog or the child is completely unexpected. And we lean in with our attention to that mystery of what will happen. And life is gloriously unexpected. And so there is the wisdom of insecurity, of uncertainty, and our measure of the pain to bear. And that's, you know, just a necessity in some way for us to find our way to hold it. It's said in the training of compassion, like the mother of the world who carries the tears of the world in her heart, we are all part of her heart and therefore called to carry that suffering, not in pity or self-pity, but in compassion and love for all. So we have this, we have the willingness to turn toward that which is difficult, and then through it, not by turning away from it, but by recognizing it and letting us touch us, that we also realize that we are so much bigger, that who we are is not defined by our trauma. Trauma has been the new big thing for the last couple of decades. There was no mention of it years ago when I began my clinical training. It's crazy. Half of what came in the door was trauma. No one talked about it. Now it's everywhere. But then people get identified. My trauma. Baby, most people have trauma. I have some serious trauma in my childhood. And that's not who I am. It's not who you are. You manage it. You honor it. You bow to it. You weep the tears. Whatever you do to it. But it's not like it goes away. It's part of life. Who we are is a joyful being saying, let's take the ride. Let's have the whole amazing experience of being human. And then there comes this profound shift of identity. And this is the invitation of mindful, loving awareness. Because who you are is not this body. It's not the conditions around you, although your body needs to be fed and the conditions and society need to be tended. It's not the sights and sounds and smells and tastes. Who you are is consciousness that was born into this body, that will leave it. You'll see when you die. I promise. It's like, wow, I float out of my body. That was quite a ride, that incarnation. You'll see. Actually, we're more than that. We are the whole field of consciousness. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, I am the the 12-year-old girl who was raped by the sea pirate, throwing herself into the ocean. And I am the pirate, my heart not capable of loving. So we're all of these, and actually more than that. We are the vastness itself. And this isn't a philosophy, nothing you have to read or study or believe. It's an experience to be known, a deep meditative experience, a psychedelic experience, wherever you find, walking in the high mountains, making love, sitting at the birth of a child, or at the bedside of someone when that mysterious moment happens. And there's this living person, and then spirit leaves the body silently like a falling star. And there's a lifeless sack of flesh, but you know it's not that person. So there's this mystery all the time. Now, I did some teaching years ago for one of the great Berkeley schools of training for psychics, Jeffrey, since you like this kind of stuff. And the woman who ran it said to me, you know, almost all my best psychics had terrible childhood. And I said, say more. She said, they needed to know when the car pulled in the drive, was mom or dad drunk or on a rage before they even entered the house. So the channels that all children have of intuition and sensitivity and capacity, because we are consciousness, they didn't get shut down. And actually, we all have these capacities. You don't say to a violin, if you have a violin and you place a second one on the table and you play a few strong bows on the strings, you'll notice that the violin on the table resonates. The strings vibrate in the same way. You don't say, oh, you shouldn't do that, or you should keep your channel open or something. It's who we are. And all it asks is quieting the mind, tending the heart, and beginning to listen to this magnificent music, the many octaves that make up life itself. And this, you know, I've just gotten happier. I was always pretty optimistic, and I've lived through some very difficult things. People live through more difficult things than I, but I had it. My father was incredibly violent and abusive, not just to me, but even more so to my mother. Throw her down the stairs, beat her black and blue, whatever, all those things in an abusive house. I've had some pretty tough trials as an adult. But basically, I'm, you know, what is it? Another poet's line, to become a messenger of wonder. To see, this is amazing. We get to be here. And mindfulness, loving awareness, opens the gates to us.
It's so beautifully put, Jack. I was thinking of asking you, how has your teaching changed? But you're really demonstrating it. I don't think analyzing it would be any better than just being here with you.
Yeah, thank you. You know, one of the great joys in the last 10, 15 years of my life, too, has been that I have had a truly loving relationship with my wife, who's also a Dharma teacher, Goodman, who founded Insight LA. She's really my beloved, and she's taught me so much. You know, when you're fortunate to be with people who carry, we'll say, kindred spirits, I learned so much from Sharon Salzberg. She was like my metta goddess, right? My loving kindness. And she had it from the beginning. And I was like this sort of warrior, tight ass young man trying to prove himself. It's, you know, the young men who look around and say, anything dangerous to do around here, right? And she would just smile with such a big heart. How about anything big to love around here? I learned from them. I learned from Trudy. I just feel so fortunate.
We do have a friend in common. I don't think we've ever talked about her, Sylvia Borstein.
Yes. Yeah, Sylvia is a heart friend. We met in the 1970s when she came. She and her husband, Seymour, are a psychiatrist, and Sylvia's a therapist. They explored every kind of spiritual thing that came, especially through Marin, which was sort of the hotbed of wacky people, and still is a little bit. But you name it, from Primal Scream and, you know, from Osho and, you know, Kundalini and tantric sex and, you know, psychic visions and blah, blah, blah. And they explored it all. And she and Seymour came to a retreat. And he said, Syl, you've got to go do this. So she came to my retreat. And she's a natural contemplative. Our culture doesn't really promote this. But in fact, many of us are, I was going to say dying. Crying is the better. Crying for time alone. And to learn how to be with ourselves. At first, it's a little hard. It's like, because the speed and I have to take care. But once you quiet down, whether it's after 3 days in the woods and you have, you know, your 10-day time, or whether it's, you know, taking a long sail or, you know, walking the Camino in Spain or whatever it is, you realize, oh, there's a whole other way to be. And she got it immediately, Sylvia Borstein. She's a wonderful teacher and an author. She wrote a whole lot of books. And she's now in her late 80s.
Yep.
And she's still cooking, you know. She's still got a beautiful spirit and a wise heart. And she's kind of a model for me, as is Joanna Macy at 95, another one of our great elders. Extraordinary ecologist, systems thinker, author of some of the most important modern Buddhist books like World as Lover, World as Self. And this is also something that's really changed over these decades. The movement of engaged Buddhism has grown, in which care for the environment, care for the vulnerable in the society, the things that were there in that Buddhist text that I described, became more and more important to all of us who are part of these meditative communities. And there was a sort of strange thing that happened when the generation of Pema Chodron and Sharon Salzberg and others went to India, Sultri Malioni, myself, or Southeast Asia to practice. Almost all of us had taken psychedelics. And we had these wow experiences and then realized, as Ramdas did, okay, you know, they don't last. Show me how I can live them, right? Or we had our own deep inclination toward mystical experience. And when we went, it's almost colonialist in its nature. We wanted, where's the deepest, highest, most enlightened? I'm going to go to Japan. I want to find the toughest, highest, best Zen master where I can get enlightened. You know, good luck. But anyway, we did that. And so we found places where the intense practice was. You sat and you didn't move and you had all these visions. But we didn't notice that they were held in this gorgeous web of fruit and flower and heart and music. They were held by community, by ritual, by chanting, by study, by the interweave of the lay people and the monastics, by devotion, and that the meditation part, we're kind of blinkered and looking, was like one little part of a whole ecosystem of awakening. I remember thinking about this because I had the good fortune to study with Don Jose Rios, who was the greatest Huichol, Indian shaman of the last generation. And I went to study with him when he was 103 and 104. He died at 107. And our American approach was to say, oh, peyote, cool, visions. Let's see, how about we take it to the lab and distill it? Can we get the essence of the peyote, but can we get, you know, it's like getting the psilocybin out of the mushroom and the, you know, out of the peyote, whatever. And now we can take that and get high and we'll all be happy ever after and see everything. And people didn't realize that the peyote ceremonies that were led by Don Jose took 3 months. And the first month, a group of people would pilgrimage from the high Huichol Sierras down to the desert floor a couple of thousand feet below, chanting part of the way and doing visions and prayers, and pick the peyote buttons as if it was a ballet of poetry and beauty and attention and care, so that it all was a sacred act, and then carry it back. Meanwhile, people in the village were weaving these amazing garments for those who were going to take the peyote, and were cooking a deer that they had specially killed to make as a sacrifice to make this special meal, and so forth. By the time you got back and sat in the circle and the rattles and her, you'd been practicing in a web of sacred activity for a very long time. And we heard all that. And so now it's come back, fortunately. And it's come back in a way that we desperately need, because we don't need just the spirituality of, you know, having some profound experiences. They're wonderful. But we need the spirituality where that profound consciousness is actually seen everywhere.
It does feel like the world needs it more now than ever before, even though, as you pointed out at the beginning of our conversation, mindfulness has spread almost to every city, and certainly here in North America. But at the same time, the problems that we're facing have also grown in enormity.
Well, it's good. We got big problems. We have powerful medicine. Now, of course, getting the patient to take the medicine is probably as much a part of healing as knowing what the right medicine is, you know. But I think they say it in the 12th program, we are beginning to have the gift of desperation.
And I suppose ultimately all we can do is our best. And if we fail, we fail knowing we gave it a good effort.
Yeah, let's fail better and more magnificently. You know, in the Bhagavad Gita, in the end, the kind of profound message that's carried by the Bhagavad Gita, at least in one part, can be summed up reflecting what you just said, Jeffrey. The secret. Okay, everybody's tuned in. Now you get the secret from Jeffrey Mishlove's show. Here it is. The secret is to act beautifully without attachment to the fruits of the action. And each part of that phrase, to act, we need to act. You can't not act. You can't stop breathing, can't stop eating. You can hide away, but you're interacting with the moths and the worms in your environment. You can't not. To act, and act beautifully. And beautifully means with our heart or dedication, that whatever language you want to use, the heart knows if it's beautiful action, if it has a good intention, if it's got if it's got respect and compassion and connection, to act beautifully. And there are a billion ways that happens. And it's not some grandstanding. I mean, even in the course of this show, there have been 1 billion acts of parents putting tacos and rice porridge and pasta and yams out for their children to have breakfast and caring for them with so much love. That's the action. And then without attachment to the outcome, you don't know what your children will become. You feed them, you love them, you teach them, and then they become who they become. And Thomas Merton, in writing to a somewhat burned out activist, said that the most important thing, he said, to concentrate on is not how your actions will turn out, but to get quiet and act from the place of your deepest, best intentions, and let the rest of it come from the truth and the care and the benevolence of the action itself. And the rest is not given to you to decide. So we in the world, in some way, we're partly the creators, which is fantastic, but we're the accompaniment to creation in another way. And we can add something. We become what sometimes is called the make weight. If you would go into an old-time market, you want to buy some rice or some fruit or something, there are these beautiful brass balance scales. And on one side is the fruit or the food, and the other side they put these weights on, a half a kilogram or something. But to get it balanced, they have a set of weights. There's the big 1K and the half a K, and it's close. And then there's this tiny set of weights, and the last one gets put on, and then the scale balances and it goes down a little bit this way. And now you have the fruit, fully the fruit that reflects what you've asked for. And those little ones are called make weights. And maybe we're the make weights in the system. Maybe your smile to that person who's having a tough day is the moment that changes how they treat their child when they get home and who that child becomes when they grow up. Every little make weight adds to this collaboration with the universe unfolding.
Once again, beautifully put. It does sometimes feel like we are so small in the face of the enormity of the issues around us. So it's good to know that every smile or gesture or, from my point of view, every interview can make a difference.
Well, it is enormous, and the challenges and the suffering is enormous in all these ways. And the heart is big enough. The great heart of compassion can hold all of that and more, because it's who you really are in the end. You are the consciousness itself, which holds it all. You are the loving awareness that's going, wow, I get to manifest in this weird incarnation. You're weird, you are, because I am, and we are. I get to do this, and what an extraordinary thing. What an extraordinary thing. And so, yes, it's not a mistake. It's part of the weave. Birth and death have to come together, light and dark, night and day, sweet and sour, joy and sorrow. We live in the realm of opposites, and you couldn't have a world of form without up and down. You couldn't have a planet with life without light and dark. It's how the universe manifests itself. Consciousness says, let me play, let me divide. Instead of being everything, let me see what everything could be. And you are that. And so it's not a mistake. Somebody asked Ramakrishna, the great Indian saint, why, Ramakrishna, is there evil in the world? And he closed his eyes, got deep, and said, to thicken the plot. You see, when you go to the movies, if you could go to see the happy songs, you know, and beautiful sunsets, and no particular drama, just joy, happiness all the time, how many times would you go to the movies? But we like the plot. We like, you know, the westerns, and we like the, you know, the murder mysteries, and we love the horror movies, or we, you know, we like the documentaries and the ones who are going to succeed and triumph over things. And that's part of the game of life, to triumph. And when you know that the heart is big enough, your heart, you can breathe and relax and say, all right, let's make a go of this.
Jack Kornfield, what a joy to be with you again after 38 years.
Jeffrey, I thank you for inviting me. I'm glad you're still, still cooking, still kicking.
Yeah.
May it continue, and may you continue, and blessings to you, and especially to everybody who's listening. You know, we share all this care for our troubled and beautiful world and for one another, and just to be able to express it itself is a gift. So thank you.
Thank you, Jack, from the bottom of my heart. And if you ever would like to spend more time with me, you're always welcome. Oh, and I hope we can do it again without waiting another 38 years.
Thank you.
And for those of you watching or listening, thank you, because you are the reason that we are here.
Three in the new Thinking Aloud dialogue series is UFOs and UAP, Are We Really Alone? Now available on Amazon.
You can now download a PDF copy or order a beautiful printed copy of issue 6 of the new Thinking Aloud magazine.